I'd first like to thank our co-sponsors for this talk, the Sustainability Council and the Metropolitan Planning Council. And I'd like to acknowledge the generous contributions of the Donnelly Foundation, the Norman Waite Harris Fund, as well as the work of our staff at PGE and the Center for International Studies in helping us put this together. I'd also like to remind everyone that we will have another distinguished lecture on Monday, May 17th. Raman Sukumar will be speaking on Elephants, Gods, and People, the Cultural History of the Asian Elephant. Tonight, however, we are very pleased to welcome Robert Glennon, the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy in the Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. Professor Glennon received his JD from Boston College Law School and PhD in American History from Brandeis University. He is the author of Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Freshwaters, and a new book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, published last year by Island Press. His provocative, insightful, and timely discussions of water policy and politics raise important issues of water as a value and a right in contemporary America. Tonight, he will speak on America's water crisis. Please join me in welcoming Professor Glennon.
Good evening, all. It's great to be here. Great to be back at the University of Chicago. I was telling some folks the first law job I ever had was in Chicago working for the American Civil Liberties Union, and it was mostly with U of C people. That was my first experience a very, very long time ago. But it's a great university. Golly, one of your former professors was just named to the Supreme Court yesterday. Another one I hear was elected president last year. So it's been an amazing run on the public policy side. It is with some trepidation that I, from Arizona, come to talk to you in Illinois about water, right next to this lovely body of water, and I'm here to talk about water. But I am, and my new book came out last year. I'd like to go through three things with you tonight. First, talk about a crisis, because for many people, it's not evident that there is a crisis in the United States. So I want to address that. Second, I'd like to talk about both some real solutions, but there are some phony solutions or surreal solutions. And then third, I'd like to suggest three things that we're not doing in the United States that I think we need to be doing to fix this crisis. So first, Ed Abbey. I assume lots of you have read some Ed Abbey at some point in your time. A curmudgeon of the First Order, lived in Tucson, drank himself to death at an unduly young age. When he was on, he was really on. And he said at one point that there's plenty of water in the Mojave Desert, unless, of course, you should try to establish a city where no city should be. What city would that be? Las Vegas. So here we have, I think maybe, is this a little too bright? You want to flip one of those things, see if we can just get a little more contrast with the slides? How about the other one? Leave that one up and... Okay. Yeah, look at you. They don't need to see me, so I can see you all. So the Bellagio fountain, right? How many people have been to Las Vegas? Right. Okay. So the Bellagio. It's you know, for some people it's the reason you go to Las Vegas. For others, it's just the epitome of wretched excess. Right. It's everything you hate about Las Vegas in that one photograph. This is a $40 million fountain. It covers 8 acres of land. It holds 27 million gallons of water. It has 1,200 nozzles that shoot the water as high as 250 feet into the desert air. And this is just the beginning. How many of you have heard of or are familiar with City Center? A couple people. It's ongoing as we sit here this evening. It is the largest privately financed construction project in American history. It pencils in at $9.1 billion. There are 7 towers ranging in height from 37 stories to 61 stories. To give you a sense of scale, over here in the shadow, this little Tinker Toy size thing, this is the Monte Carlo Casino, one of the largest casinos on the Strip, and you can barely see it next to these. It's an MGM Grand project, some of the best architects from around the world. They expect that build out, that this will house between 50 and 70,000 people. Now, the metropolitan area of Las Vegas already has 1.8 million people, and yet they are still booming. For sure, the blossom has been somewhat softened by the recent economic downturn, but they are still doing incredibly well. What's stunning about this, in part, is that there's only one casino. Las Vegas has an uncanny ability to reinvent itself. And now, in the light of Indian gaming, in the light of Atlantic City, in the light of other competition, they're not about gaming. It's about other things. Conventioneers come in, and then they want to enjoy the entertainment, the fine dining, the club scene, the boutiques, all the rest of the nightlife that goes with that. That's what Las Vegas has been about. And yet, when you look at this photograph, that does not look like a skyline from the American West. It looks like Manhattan, Singapore, Hong Kong, not Phoenix or Los Angeles. There's only one problem, and that problem is that Las Vegas has run out of water. Now, they came to this realization, particularly the head of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, Patricia Mulroy, pretty late in the game. For a long time, she was sanguine. Plenty of water. We don't need to worry about limiting growth. But now, she's had a conversion. And like some people who have a religious conversion, she is incredibly fervent about water conservation and changing the culture in Las Vegas. And among the things that she is doing is she has offered to build desalination plants for the cities of Tijuana and San Diego on the Pacific coast. And in turn, Las Vegas would take their Colorado River water out of Lake Mead and use it instead of those cities. She has embarked on a program to pay people to rip out lawns as much as $2 per square foot. This in a city that loves its lawns. And they have put their money where their mouths are. They have spent $150 million paying people to rip out lawns. Then she's embarked on another program, which is to build a $3 billion pipeline to bring in water from the north central part of Nevada, 250 miles north of Las Vegas, on the border with Utah. Now, if you think about your history, and you think about, now, who exactly was the settling community on this section? Because they're not happy. And who were they? They were members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There's one more thing that Pat Mulroy is doing, and that is she's running public service announcements to try to persuade people not to waste water. And this is one that has appeared on Las Vegas television stations. Las Vegas has a different sense about what's appropriate to run on family television stations than some other communities. All right, so let me get this straight. So she's paying you to rip out the lawn, she's trying to steal the Mormons' water, she's threatening you with bodily harm. But how can she possibly justify the water use on the Strip, that Bellagio fountain and the pirate lagoons and all the rest of the things that you see when you visit Las Vegas? Well, pretty easily, actually, because the surprising thing about Las Vegas and the Strip is how little water it uses. 3% of Las Vegas's water. And when Steve Wynn, the developer of the Bellagio, came to her and said, "I need a water feature. Don't tell me I can't, just tell me whatever it is I need to do." And she said, "Steve, are you prepared to double plumb the hotel, to put a reverse osmosis system in the basement, to install low flow fixtures, aerators on the faucet, instant on hot water?" He said, "I'll do all of it." And he did. And they all do. So the surprising thing about that Bellagio fountain, it's all reclaimed water, all recycled water, as is every other water feature on the Strip. And yet, even though they only use 3% of the water, they are the economic driver in the state, bar none. In Nevada, as in every western state, farmers use the lion's share of the water. In Nevada, it's upwards of 85%. That use of water by farmers generates a farm economy that supports about 6,000 jobs. 6,000 jobs is about the same number of jobs as one casino on the Strip. So when you start to think about water and the value of water and how it's used and what's driving an economy, she's got a pretty strong case for using water to keep those tourists coming in and keep those conventioneers coming to Las Vegas. I start with Las Vegas both because people both love it and hate it, sometimes at the same time, but also because it's a symbol about what's going forward. Because despite their naughty slogan that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, when it comes to water, that is the furthest thing from the truth. We have an insight into the future when we look at Vegas. Ben Franklin, one of our wisest founding fathers, when the well's dry, we know the worth of water. He was wrong. The truth of the matter is we Americans are spoiled. We wake up in the morning, we turn on the tap, and out comes as much water as we want for less than we pay for cell phone service or for cable television. We think in the United States of water as we do the air, infinite and inexhaustible, when in fact, for all practical purposes, it's very finite and very exhaustible. The crisis, just since 2007, here are some of the things that have happened.
Close by, the Great Lakes, Lake Superior, too low to float fully loaded cargo ships, requiring offloading of hundreds of tons of freight and dramatically increasing the price of shipping. The commercial fishing season off the coast of California and Oregon, canceled. Now, for the second year in a row, and they're now going into a third year, which is idling hundreds of fishing boats and decimating fishing communities up and down the coast. Three other western states have denied power plants, coal-fired power plants, not enough water to run them. In Southern California, scores of residential and commercial projects canceled, and Atlanta, Georgia came within 90 days of having its principal water supply dry out. Now, what's stunning about this litany is it's not the usual recitation of environmental harms, of low flows in rivers, of spikes in temperature, of threatened and endangered species, of saltwater intrusion or subsidence. It's not about that. This is about the health of the American economy. And we may fret in the United States about running out of oil. The American economy just as oil does. This is Lake Lanier, Georgia's principal water, Atlanta's principal water supply for 4.5 million people. And this is what it looked like in 2007 and 2008. You would think that when officials looked at something like that, they would say, we have to take action. This is so serious, it's hard to believe. It's unfathomably bad. But you would be wrong. The state of Georgia took baby steps, aggressive steps to address their problems. Georgia's fighting with Alabama to the west and Florida to the south over this three-way system, three-river system. Lake Lanier is at the top of the photograph on the Chattahoochee River. And in the midst of this drought, the governor, Sonny Perdue, told his environmental agency that they needed to do something. So they imposed some modest restrictions on washing cars, watering lawns, filling swimming pools. Then the governor decided he needed to do something more dramatic. And so he decided to pray for rain. And the governor scheduled a prayer vigil on the Capitol steps, and he gathered with ministers and people of faith, and they prayed for rain. The governor was not a guy to take chances, because he didn't schedule a prayer vigil until the weather forecast was predicted it was going to rain. Then the state legislature, not to be outdone by the governor, got into business. And if you look up at the top there, you see that there's the state of Tennessee with the Tennessee River. And in 2008, the Georgia legislature passed a resolution that proclaimed that the survey that set the boundary with Tennessee was set erroneously, and that the border between Georgia and Tennessee should be moved 1 mile north. And that would just serendipitously bring that little hook in the Tennessee River down into Georgia, where Georgia could put its straw in the glass and start sucking away till its heart's content. What Georgia did not do, and still has not done, as we sit here, is to place new restrictions on diverting from the rivers or drilling wells. You do not even need a permit in Georgia to drill a well unless you are going to pump more than 100,000 gallons of water per day. And then you need a permit. And the permit is easy to come by. So I have the simple-minded notion of our water supply as a giant milkshake glass. And I think of each demand for water as a straw in the glass. And what the state of Georgia and many other states in the U.S. do is to permit a limitless number of straws into the same glass. For those of you who studied ecology, it's the epitome of the tragedy of the commons. It's a common pool resource, unrestricted access to it, every rational economic incentive on the part of those who can exploit it is to exploit it, and by golly, they do when the water tables are gone. It's an absolutely bizarre system. There's one other thing that happened in Georgia. How many of you know Stone Mountain, which is a theme park, amusement park outside of Atlanta? Well, this is Stone Mountain's latest venture. They partnered with Coca-Cola to create Coca-Cola Snow Mountain. And they issued a press release. This was the vice president of guest experiences for Stone Mountain, issued a press release that proclaimed that that research had disclosed that very few Atlanta children had ever had a satisfactory snow experience. You hope they weren't giving PhDs for this quality work. So very few people. So they decided to embark on an outdoor snowmaking project, which they did, and they brought it online on October 1st in the middle of a drought on the day when the temperature reached 81 degrees Fahrenheit. And these people were making snow outdoors. We humans have an infinite capacity to deny reality. So this is Georgia. You start with a drought, it's a hydrogeological cycle. The drought makes you aware, eventually you become concerned. The concern leads to panic, but then it rains, and then you become apathetic. We like to put things off. If we, you know, someone once said that Americans will always do the right thing after they have explored every other option. So in this case, what you have in Georgia is foolishness. They're looking over the precipice. It's a horrible state of affairs. 90 days of having 4.5 million people without water, and they have done next to nothing. Why? Because they assume this is a temporary problem. This is drought. Drought's an aberration. Drought's something that will go away with the next drenching rain. Here's the problem, though. The scientists who looked at this have found that indeed there was nothing particularly unique about the drought that beset the Southeast in the last couple of years. There have been other downturns in precipitation, low levels of rain in years past. Well, what was different? What was different was the population growth. Metro Atlanta is the epitome of sprawl. They add about 100,000 people per year to the metro area. Interstate 75 that goes through Atlanta has one portion that is 15 lanes wide, and the cars are bumper to bumper. So they're widening it to 23 lanes. It will be 388 feet wide, the widest highway in the United States. We humans have an infinite capacity to deny reality. Now, from my perspective, the reality here is population growth. That is the elephant in the room of every environmental problem. There's none you can mention to me that once you scratch the surface, don't come down. In fact, there's just too darn many of them. And the same thing could be said about California's drought now as the Georgia drought. Since the last drought of equal severity ended in California, which was in 1992, the population of California has gone up by a staggering 7 million people. Million. Since we began about 20 minutes ago, the population of California has gone up by 20 people. The population of the United States nudged over 300 million just about 2 years ago. And yet the Census Bureau predicts that by the year 2050, the population in the US will be an astonishing 420 million people. Where on earth are we going to get the resources, water and other, to support an additional 120 million US fellow citizens? Then you think about, in addition to the macro picture, you get the internal migration problem. Because people are moving from where the water is, like Michigan, to where the water isn't, like Arizona. That's what I did. In 1985, I moved from Michigan to Arizona, and lots of other people have as well. And so you're finding the states that are growing most quickly are North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Texas, and of course the Southwest. All the states with the most severe water problems. Then there's one more, and that third one is global climate change. And despite the Fox News naysayers and the like, there's no doubt that it's real. There's no doubt anyone, I think, is doubting that the Earth is warming. And that is creating immense problems for water supply. The predictions for the flow in the Western rivers are very terrifying. In the Colorado system, it's anywhere from a downturn of 20% to 45% over the next fill in the number of decades, depending on which model you want to go by. Even right here in the Great Lakes, why is the level of Lake Superior so low? Well, there's some evidence that the surface water temperature in Lake Superior has gone up something like 5 degrees in 20 or 30 years. That's a stunning change for a big body of water. Why is there so little ice cover in Lake Superior? Why are the levels so low? You have less ice cover, you have more evaporation loss, warmer temperatures. And people think of the Great Lakes as some big renewable supply. That's just a complete myth. And what happened in the Soviet Union with the Aral Sea is a sober reminder of what can happen to the Great Lakes. It's actually a quite fragile ecosystem. So you put together population growth, internal migration patterns, and global climate change, and we have a huge mismatch of supply and demand. Now here's another demand for water. This is not what I would call an important demand for water, but it's an indulgent demand for water. This is Kohler's Power Shower. It's very popular in Phoenix, which is why we in Tucson look down on people who live in Phoenix. These could all take the paint off walls, but none of them get her hair wet. Shouldn't one of these 10 shower heads get her hair wet? Bottled water, that's another recent demand. It's fairly frivolous and indulgent. I was the first to point the finger at bottled water in my book, Water Follies. This is Jennifer Aniston pimping for Glossop Smart Water. If you drink smart water, you'll have a nice body and get really rich. If you haven't seen the Penny and Teller skit on bottled water, you've got to get it off of YouTube. It's from the Showtime show, Showtime cable show. And it shows a fancy California restaurant. And instead of a wine steward, there's a water steward. And instead of a wine list, there's a water list. And the guy's got the apron over the arm, and the patrons are taking these glasses of bottled water and sniffing them like you might a good French Bordeaux. Flavors, yeah, good back palate, you know, all this. And then the next clip shows Penn out back with a garden hose. there are other demands for water that are far more serious, though. And here I'd like to talk to you about the energy water problem. Because in the United States, our energy policy has essentially ignored the water consequences of this policy. And the consequences are immense. And the poster child for this, in my judgment, is ethanol. Now, ethanol is debatable and controversial for lots of reasons. I don't have a dog in that fight. But what I think has gone largely unnoticed, what I'm trying to draw some attention to, is the requirements for water in producing ethanol. So even if you have a plant that recycles its water, a refinery for ethanol, it still takes 4 gallons of water to refine 1 gallon of ethanol. That, however, turns out to be the proverbial drop in the bucket. In 2007, Congress passed a law that requires that we produce 36 billion gallons of biofuels in the next 10 years, by 2012 years, by 2022. 36 billion times 4 times the amount of water it takes to produce the corn. You've got to grow the corn first. Now that's not too bad in Illinois, or even you can go somewhere in Iowa and parts of Minnesota. But the moment you start past the 100th meridian somewhere in here, and you start to think about all of this area of the country, you can't grow anything unless you irrigate. In the Midwest and the humid areas, you can just depend on Mother Nature for the rainfall. But when you move further west, then you have to have artificial irrigation. And it may take as much as 2,500 gallons of water to grow enough corn to refine 1 gallon of ethanol. I can't do that math. I know it's a big number, more than my fingers and toes. And then you look west and you realize that the state of California has a goal of producing 1 billion gallons of ethanol in the next few years, which would require every drop of water that goes through the Sacramento-San Joaquin Bay Delta that currently irrigates 7 million acres in the Central Valley and that provides water to the Southern California coastal cities. And it would take all that water and require it to be used to grow corn. We humans have an infinite capacity to deny reality. This is not the only problematic energy source. Let me tell you about one more, and that's solar energy. Solar, isn't solar green? Well, solar is green, but solar can use a lot of water. Not photovoltaic, not those systems you see on your neighbor's rooftop, those panels. Those take sun's energy and directly convert it into growing, takes the sun's energy and directly convert it into electricity. But with very few exceptions, photovoltaic is not commercially viable at utility scale. What is commercially viable at utility scale is something called concentrating solar thermal. And that takes the sun's heat to heat a medium, to boil water, to create steam, to spin a turbine, to generate electricity. If that sounds like an old-fashioned power plant, it's because it is an old-fashioned power plant, with the single exception that at step one, you use the sun's heat instead of natural gas, nuclear, or coal fire. Now, Congress 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, told the Interior and Energy Departments to collaborate and to site 10,000 megawatts of hydro or non-hydro power, renewables, which would be wind or solar. Where are they siting this energy supply? In the desert southwest. That would be southern Nevada, southeastern California, and western Arizona. Right smack in the middle of the Mojave Desert. Ed Abbey must be chortling in his grave at the thought of this. As we sit here this evening, the Bureau of Land Management has before it request for 150 permits for power plants located in the Mojave Desert on more than 1 million acres of your federal land. And most of these plants want to use water to cool the system. Groundwater in a place that gets 3 or 4 inches of water of rain a year. We humans have an infinite capacity to deny reality. The energy-water connection has some surprising aspects. We now know not only does it take a lot of water to produce energy, but it also takes a lot of energy to pump, move, cleanse, and deliver water. Indeed, 20% of all the electricity used in California is just for that. Moving water around, treating it, and delivering it. 20%. And here's a company that uses a lot of water and a lot of energy, but you could stay here all night before you guessed it. It's Google. Google? I thought they had that neat Mountain View campus and saunas and free lunch and all that stuff. No, that's just for the people who do the algorithm. What Google is a high-tech company, but beneath the surface is an industrial company, because this is what runs their servers. In fact, this is called a server farm. Inside are thousands of computers, all linked up and all generating heat. Think 10,000 toaster ovens and you get the idea. And what Google needs to do is to dissipate the heat. And what do they use? Water. A lot of water. Why? Because water is a great coolant, as we know from the radiators in our automobiles. The internet already uses 1.5% of the electricity in the United States, and that figure is expected to double in the next 18 months. We have an important need in the United States to ensure that Intel, Google, and all the other providers have enough water so that they will locate their chip facilities and their server farms in the United States with all the good-paying jobs that go with those. That's an important national interest, because it relates to the health of the American economy. And we're not doing a very good job at figuring out what's important and what's not. So, real and served real solutions. But typically in the United States, historically in the United States, when we have a water supply problem, we think that we can engineer our way out of it. And that usually means you divert water from a river, you build a dam, you drill a well. We're very good at building dams. We've built so many dams in the United States that there are only 60 rivers in the whole country
that haven't been dammed. The reality, though, is that there are very few dam sites left that are not dangerous. All of them are expensive. All of them have hideous environmental consequences associated with damming rivers. They are very politically controversial. The reality is that we're taking dams out in the United States, whether it's the Klamath in Oregon or the Penobscot in Maine. We're removing dams and restoring hundreds of miles of free-flowing rivers. We're not building new dams. And people who think we're going to aren't thinking very, going to go down this path again, aren't thinking very clearly. Same with more diversions from rivers. Already, hundreds of rivers are absolutely hammered by the low flows from diversions upstream. And I don't mean just tiny little streams. I'm talking about big rivers like the Rio Grande or the Colorado, but they don't even reach the ocean anymore. The rivers are totally dried up and don't reach the ocean. Nor is groundwater pumping a solution. The poster child for excessive groundwater pumping is the Ogallala Aquifer. That stretches from the panhandle of Texas up into the Dakotas. It's been described as the breadbasket of the United States, but those orange and red colors indicate declines in the water table of upwards of 150 feet. In other places around the United States, including right here nearby Chicago, the decline in the aquifers from outlying communities to the Chicago metro area are in the hundreds of feet. What we are basically doing is pumping water in an unsustainable fashion and drawing the water table down. It is true that there is a hydrologic cycle. It is true that we are drinking the same water as the dinosaurs drank, but we are using it in ways that are unsustainable. It took thousands of years for this water to accumulate, and yet we are using it up in mere decades. You do not need to be a rocket scientist to see the handwriting on that particular wall. And there are horrible environmental consequences associated with this excessive groundwater pumping. This is an earth fissure outside of Phoenix, Arizona from 2005. This is a stunning photograph. See where the land surface was in 1925? And see where it was by 1977? The land actually dropped, subsided 30 feet over a 50-year period from groundwater pumping. The impact on our rivers and streams is quite dramatic from excessive groundwater pumping. You don't usually think about this question. Where does the water come from if it hasn't rained? And the answer is it comes from the ground. Because the river is always the low point in the basin, and it's receiving inflow from the surrounding land, subsurface laterally under the force of gravity, to provide flows to the rivers and streams. This is a subsiding sinkhole in Florida. You can see the fellow standing on the side. This is a before and after photograph from my home state of Massachusetts, the Ipswich River just outside of Boston in 2003. This isn't Arizona or Nevada. This is Massachusetts, a state that gets more rain than Seattle. And yet groundwater pumping has dried up the Ipswich River in 5 of the last 8 years. So people who think that business as usual, more diversions, more dams, more wells are the solution, are not thinking very clearly. Some people continue to think that there's going to be some oasis out there, some place where we can go to import more water. This has often been the work of dreamers. Some people think an iceberg in the Arctic can be towed to LA. A river in British Columbia can be brought down to Oregon or Northern California. These proposals crop up periodically. No one usually seems to ask the Canadians what they think about the idea of taking a river from British Columbia, but people propose it anyway. The most recent iteration is a guy in Colorado by the name of Aaron Millian, and he would like to take water from Flaming Gorge Reservoir, put it in a pipeline, bring it along the I-80 corridor, bring it down past Fort Collins in Denver and all the way down to Colorado Springs. Now, dreamers sometimes pull things off, but he faces, in this case, an incredibly complicated set of obstacles. But the most significant obstacle he faces is something called the Rocky Mountains. Then there's cloud seeding. Another truly idiotic idea. Mark Twain said, everyone complains about the weather, no one does anything about it. For 60 years, people have been experimenting with cloud seeding, dumping silver iodide out of planes or shooting it up from cannons on the ground. But the National Research Council issued an important report just a few years back that said despite these six decades, there is, quote, no convincing scientific evidence, unquote, that cloud seeding works. The problem is basically the scientific method. You can't replicate it. So you throw some silver iodide out of a plane, and then it rains. Well, how do you know that it rained? Because you threw the silver iodide out of a plane. You cause some correlation problem. And how do you know it rained more because of that? If you can't replicate it, then why should you be spending money on it? But people are. Water districts and utilities all around the American West are throwing good money at cloud seeding, hoping it will work. Hoping it will work. We humans have an infinite capacity to deny reality. How about desalination? Well, actually, now this is a solution, but it's not a silver bullet. There's no single thing that we can do to take care of this water crisis. There is instead, I argue, a portfolio of options that we have available to us. No single template that we can impose on any particular community, but there are a variety of choices that that community can make, and one of them will be desalination. It's been done by Middle East countries for a long time, island nations, cruise ships, but it's not a silver bullet for three reasons. One, it's incredibly expensive. The membranes for reverse osmosis are very high tech, prone to fouling, require frequent replacement, they're very expensive. Of money, it's a big deal. Second, incredibly energy intensive, because it's all done under extreme pressure, which is one of the reasons why the membranes foul. But that pressure, of course, takes a lot of energy, and now we know that energy takes a lot of water. That's the second problem. And the third problem is this. When you desalinate water, you push the ocean water or brackish water against the membrane, and you end up with potable water on the far side. But on this side, you end up with a much smaller volume of water, but it contains 100% of the salts that you started with. So you've got this briny substance, and you have to get rid of it. How do you get rid of it? What most desal companies want to do is to take an existing power plant and to use its outflow pipe and just dump it right there into the ocean. But dumping it in close to shore likely will hammer the local estuary, and estuaries, we now know, thanks to ecohydrology, are incredibly important for nursery conditions for shrimp and crabs and all kinds of other marine animals that depend on that mix of fresh and salt water. If you just suddenly dump a huge slug of super saline water in there, you're asking for a disaster. So there are problems with desal, but it is technically feasible to do it. Don't think you're going to be seeing farmers all around the West using desalinated water. But if you're a community that has a severe water problem, has some money, has few other options, then desal will be part of your portfolio. How about recycled water? Well, we have to recycle water. Now, this has a problem. It's a political pushback problem. In addition to this comment editorially by the San Diego Trib, one of their reporters wrote a story that described the proposal as a toilet-to-tap proposal. Well, that was dead on arrival. So people don't want to think about drinking sewage. And who wants to? Of course, if you think about the Mississippi River, someone calculated that it's been reused about 100 times between the time it goes from Minnesota down to New Orleans. But people don't like to think about that. But we don't need to think about that. There's no need for us to think about using reclaimed water for our drinking water. In Tucson, where I live, about 10% of the water that Tucson Water provides, we use for watering golf courses, turf facilities, parks, cemeteries, highway medians, light industrial applications. Google is now moving in many places around the United States to use reclaimed water for its server farms. So there are plenty of things we can do with reclaimed water other than drink it. And in many places, people aren't even trying use this water. Los Angeles has a huge treatment plant that produces a volume of water equal to the seventh largest city in the entire country. What do they do with this treated water? They dump it in the ocean. We can do better. What we need to be thinking about is smaller decentralized treatment facilities
and we need to keep water local to be reusing it in order to take care of this crisis. Still, it's not a silver bullet. It's expensive. It requires a separate system of pipes, often painted purple. At least that's what we do in Tucson, because you certainly don't want to have any confusion between the reclaim system and the potable system. But it's a supply that grows as the population grows. So that's a really good piece of news. A third thing we can do is to have aggressive conservation. Now, this particular quotation from Senator Feinstein is very unfortunate. It's really incredibly stupid. Southern California, San Diego, and Los Angeles gets about 13 inches of rain a year. We in Tucson get 12 inches of rain a year. We're in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. But you wouldn't know that San Diego or Los Angeles are deserts because they import more water than any place else on Earth, and they have this culture of thinking it's their God-given right to have lawns and gardens. It's so embedded in Southern California's stuff, its DNA, that the mayor of San Diego, within the last year, described his city as entering a new era in water history. Well, Mr. Mayor, why are you so pleased? Because new regulations would prohibit San Diego citizens from watering their lawns more than three times a week. No, this is not a new era. This is rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic, Mr. Mayor. You need to get outside the box. As long as you have a United States Senator saying something as silly as this, it's tough to get outside that box. But there are other people around the United States doing incredibly interesting water conservation. At the homeowner level, you've got water harvesting going on. This is a photograph from San Juan Island off of Seattle. And what they do is they collect the water that hits the roof during the rainy season, and then they store it in the silo. They triple filter it, they run it through an anti-germicidal light, and they have a year-round supply completely off the grid. There's a group of women in Oakland, California, self-styled the gray water gorillas. These gals are advocating taking water from washing machines and using it in the backyard. In Tucson, Arizona, we have a fellow, Brad Lancaster, who's really the guru nationwide about harvesting. A measure of his success is that Walmart is now selling his water harvesting book. It tells you something about how that's catching on. On the utility scale, the big picture is something called green infrastructure. And that's something that Chicago is just starting to put its toe in the pool about. And green infrastructure is the idea that you need to reduce the amount of water that goes to your treatment facility. And so when you get a rainstorm, unfortunately, 800 communities in the United States take their rainwater and they mix it with their sewer water. And then they have to treat as though it were contaminated with fecal matter the entire supply. So what you're doing now, or seeing cities like Portland and Seattle and others do, is they're putting in different ways of rooftop gardening, swales, collection facilities, taking this water supply and trying to recharge it to the aquifer. Because there's one fundamental problem with growth. You start with rainfall that hits the ground and it percolates into the soil and eventually goes down and replenishes that milkshake glass, right? It goes to the aquifer. But when you take that raw land and you substitute hardscape, whether it's parking lots or rooftops or roads, all of a sudden you get runoff. You get no infiltration whatsoever. That's a real problem. And so it affects the supply, and what this green infrastructure concept is doing is trying to figure out ways to slow the movement of water, to recharge the aquifer with a good chunk of this water, cleaning it along the way, and to reduce the demand on the municipal treatment system. So there's a lot we can do in conservation. And now I have to tell you, there are communities that have already done all this. We in Tucson, pretty good at water conservation. San Antonio, Albuquerque, also good at water conservation. So reusing water, conserving water, and desalinating water are options. But in some places, it's still not enough. We need to do more. And so a new approach. What are we going to do? Well, there are three things I'd like you to think about. First, I want to take dead aim at the American toilet.
as the biggest waste of water in the United States. A century ago, Teddy Roosevelt said, civilized people should do something with sewage other than put it in the drinking water. He was right then, and he's right now. But that is exactly what we do in the United States. Think about it for just a moment. What we do is we get water from the treatment plant that's been treated, but we don't use that water. We only use 10% of that water for cooking and drinking. Fully a third of this water that we get, we use outdoors for watering landscape, our rose bushes and our lawns. Indoor use, fully a third of that we flush away. That's 6 billion gallons of water a day, or 2 trillion gallons of water a year, merely to get rid of human waste. If you think about it at all, it's a truly weird system. It's a system that wastes water, wastes money, wastes energy by treating to potable quality this entire supply when only 10% of it is used for cooking and drinking. And it compromises human health. It turns out that the EPA is concerned about, quote, emerging contaminants. These are the wonders of the modern pharmaceutical industry. They're the things that we've grown accustomed to taking, the pills that we take, birth control pills, erectile dysfunction medicines, hormone supplements, antibiotics, anything that comes in that brown container that we get from the pharmacist. That's a pill that we take. Our bodies absorb some of it. We excrete the rest of it. We flush it away. It goes to the treatment plant, and it is not removed. And the scientists who have studied the treatment plant water downstream are finding scary stuff. Deformed fish, intersex frogs, these are so-called endocrine disrupting compounds that are in our water supply. Now, I don't want to be the sky is falling guy. These are microscopic parts per trillion measurements. But we do not know the human health consequences of ingesting these compounds. There are not established threshold limits beyond which it is a threat to human health. And it's not just one drug we're talking about. It's multiple doses of different drugs, and you don't even know what it is. But there is one amusing, it's sort of a community-wide urinalysis. And it was found in one community that cocaine and ecstasy use went up on the weekend. You know, if you want to get high, that's okay, but it should be your choice, not because you drank the wrong water. So my point is really that Roosevelt was right a century ago. He's still right. What we need is a national commission, a federal commission, to explore waterless ways to deal with human waste. It's a system that is long overdue for an overhaul. Already there are waterless urinals. We have hundreds of them around the University of Arizona campus. There are composting and incinerating toilets. Whether they're ready for prime time, I'm not so certain, but we haven't tried. And given the terrible state of the infrastructure in water and sewer in the United States, let's not spend $1 trillion rebuilding this stupid system because Roosevelt was right. Now, I know this is a tough sell. And some people really care about flush toilets. Ann Coulter has said the flush toilet is mankind's single greatest invention. I hope no student at the University of Chicago names the flush toilet as mankind's single greatest invention. I think there are other things on the list. But it shows you just how deeply and emotionally engaged people are about this. But Ms. Coulter goes even further. And she says that people like me that want to take away her flush, she uses this epithet. Just terrible. She says that I'm a liberal. And that liberals are people who, quote, advocate living in their own excrement. Freud would have a field day. But I'm not going to go there. So first, rethink the toilet. Second, it's time for you to pay. You got to pay for the water. You're paying more for your cell phone and your cable than you are for water. You got to change that. Truth is, you're not even paying for the water. Even if you write a bill, a check for a bill, to the municipal water department or to a private company regulated by the Public Utility Commission of the state, the only thing you're paying for is the cost of service. The rate structure is what's called revenue neutral. The amount of money coming in is equal to the amount of money going out. There is no commodity charge for the water itself. And in fully a third of American communities, the rate structure is decreasing block rates, so that the more water you use, the less you pay for that final item of water. That is truly bizarre. But if that weren't bad enough, in many communities around the states, there are no meters, and that includes Chicago. 350,000 homes in the city of Chicago have no meters. Same with Sacramento, with Fresno, other communities. This is not the right incentive, and it matters. Clovis, California has meters. They use 200 gallons per person per day. Right next door is Fresno, no meters. They use 300. It's nothing more than supply and demand and pricing. Now on this, I want to be really clear. We need to protect people of modest means. And the way to do that, I argue, is to recognize a human right to water. If the richest country in the history of the world cannot make that commitment to our people, we're a sorry lot. The truth is, it's a small amount of water. You multiply 12 to 15 gallons per person per day, you end up with 1% of what we use in the United States each day. What we need to do is to take that issue off the table by recognizing a human right to water. And then we can talk about how to price appropriately the other 99%. We need to use price signals as a way to encourage conservation. Now, there's a third leg of this three-legged stool, and that's we're entering an era of water reallocation. Now, sometimes, and this is the poster that shows from Michigan, the fear that New Mexico's coming in, and California, Utah, and Texas. I don't know why. They didn't mention Arizona in this one. Governor Richardson, when he was running for president last year, said that Wisconsin had plenty of water. Of course, he said this in Nevada, and the Wisconsin people weren't too happy about this. I want to tell you that this is all wrong. The idea that we in the Southwest want to divert all the Great Lakes is crazy. We'd be happy with one. No, we're not going to divert any. And the reason is has to do with my last slide. Water's too cheap. It's absolutely inconceivable that we could start piping water from the Great Lakes to the Southwest because the price of water is too low. We pay for water in the United States about one penny for 4 gallons. When water gets to the price of oil, $3 for 1 gallon, then we can talk about having a pipeline to the Southwest. But meanwhile, you've done a good job, and with the Great Lakes Compact that was signed by President Bush 2 years ago, you now basically have put a limit on almost all exports from the Great Lakes region. The real problem the Great Lakes has now are people either in the Great Lakes or close by. Perhaps you've studied the problem of Waukesha, Wisconsin. They're just over the divide. They're not in the Great Lakes Basin. That's where the threat is. The threat to the Great Lakes is not from distant states, but from your immediate neighbors. Okay, back to the third leg, the era of water reallocation. That's what we must do. It's really back to the milkshake glass. Because we can't keep putting new straws in the glass. And so what I want to do is to have a system that would be basically one of demand offsets. If you want to put another straw in the public supply, you will be required to persuade someone else to take her straw out of the glass. And so it's a water marketing system. It's a system of sales and leases of water exchanges that will free up water for new demands by paying people who currently are using the water to make do with less. Now, the example I give you of this is a steel company in Utah called Geneva Steel. It was a company that was built during the Second World War by the U.S. government. At the end of the war, they spun this company off to U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel operated it for the balance of the 20th century. But by the end of the 20th century, gosh, the steel industry in the United States was on the ropes. Pittsburgh had factories with 100-year-old blast furnaces. Detroit's making automobiles that no one wants to buy. The Chinese steel industry is young, but they're aggressive and they're growing quickly. Competition is severe. Eventually, despite efforts to cut costs and so on, Geneva Steel goes into bankruptcy. They try to reorganize, they are unsuccessful. And so they need to liquidate their assets. Fortunately, they had some substantial assets to liquidate. First, They had the land itself. And this company was located, this plant was located just outside of Provo, Utah, where Brigham Young University is. 1,700 acres of prime developable land brought in $46 million. Then they sold the plant itself to a steel company for $40 million. They had an iron ore mine that fetched an additional $10 million from a mining company. They had pollution reduction credits, a little bit of an irony here. Since they were no longer in business, they weren't polluting, so they had a right to sell the credits to someone else who could pollute. And all told, this brought in $100 million, quite a stunning amount of water, money. And then they sold the water rights. The water rights were worth more than all of the other substantial assets combined. This is the future of water in the United States, as it should be. What happened in Utah was that the state engineer got in the material and said, I'm not going to play this game of smoke and mirrors anymore. No more charades, no more pretend, wink, wink, nod, nod, that you can put in a diversion and that the environment downstream from that diversion won't be hammered or the senior appropriator won't lose his or her water rights. No more pretending that this milkshake glass can be tapped into forever and that you can put a new straw into the well, into the aquifer, and not have the water level go down. That game is over. You want to do a deal, you bring water to the table. It's not a no-growth system, it's a demand offset system. It says at the very least, we need to insist that people not make the situation worse, that the public supply be protected. The reality is that the government has done an abysmal job of exercising its stewardship obligation to protect our public water supply. And we need for the government to set limits on how people are using it. It's just that important. Now, in a way, this is a phony story. And the reason is there are not a lot of steel companies out there. We're going to free up water for Google, Intel, the environment, housing developers. It's going to come from agriculture, because agriculture is where the water is being used. And the question then becomes, what happens to the farming community and to farmers as a group in the United States in this new era of water marketing? Well, I just finished a National Science Foundation project with two economists where we studied 12 Western states over 25 years. We had a data set of 3,200 sales and leases of water rights with a tremendous amount of water changing hands, about 31 million acre feet, which is twice the annual flow of the Colorado River. And we found, quite surprisingly, that even though this water almost entirely went from agriculture into industrial, municipal, and environmental, that farm income held constant for inflation did not go down. How can that possibly be? Well, that can be for three reasons. First, farmers are savvy business people. And when faced with an opportunity to make money, they look around and they say, you know, that land up at the barn, it's all clay soil. Very low yields, bushels per acres. Let's take it out of production. Or they say, yeah, that's a lot of money that the developer's offering. We could do some major on-farm improvements, line our canals, move from a flood irrigation to a more efficient center pivot system, or move from a center pivot to an even more efficient drip or micro system with the money that this developer is offering us. Or third, they rethink their crop mix. And that's where this photograph comes in. This is a photograph from Yuma, Arizona. It's not a place you want to be eating lettuce from lately. That didn't go over well. They were supposed to laugh. That's the story that's going around about E. coli. It's all from humor. So, but that was a bromane. This is icebergs. So this is classic farm labor conditions. Horrible back-breaking work. Takes a score of workers the better part of the day. Those heads of lettuce that you see when you buy a head of iceberg lettuce, it doesn't come like that in the field. It comes with all these other leaves around it, and they need to be macheted away, which is what this is. So another way of thinking of all of this is wasted water. It's water that was used to grow leaves that have no economic value. because the first thing you needed to do was to cut the leaves away. So what this farmer did is he said, I'm going to try something different. So he went with baby lettuces. And you all have been eating baby lettuces. And you've been paying a lot of money for those baby lettuce boxes. They're triple washed. They're incredibly convenient. And if you buy one of those big boxes, you could spend $8 or $10 for a box of lettuce leaves. And the farmers noticed it, and they understood fully well the added value to American consumers, not only because they liked the taste of these things, but because they were so darn convenient. And this is how it's harvested. On the left side, you have your classic tractor trailer. And on the right side, you have what I call a gigantic electric razor. It's gas-fired, but it's the same point. It's cutting the lettuce leaves off just above the root zone. They're flowing up this conveyor belt, where at the back of the conveyor belt, there's a worker taking the boxes that the lettuces are falling into, and then moving them by conveyor belt over to the tractor trailer. When they finish the row, that's what it looks like. The trailer, when it's full of the full boxes of lettuce, goes off the market. Then you can run the tractor part back down the row and you add some more fertilizer. No need for pesticides, because the seeds are sown so closely together there are no weeds. You already have roots coming up, and within a certain number of days you can do the whole darn thing all over again. You can't keep doing this. In the end, though, I'm optimistic, because yes, it's a crisis, no doubt about it. Yes, it threatens our economy, no doubt about that. But we have things we can do. There are paths in this road, forks to be chosen. And what we can do is to prevent the crisis from becoming a catastrophe. But this is a serious issue. Satan got it right. You can't breathe the air, drink the water, not much else matters, and it's not one to sit out. But we should be optimistic. I offer a portfolio, a menu of options. What we now need, what we really need, is the moral courage and the political will to act. Thank you very much. Any comments or questions, observations? Sure, back.
If a number of desalinization plants were built around the ocean areas of the United States, would that solve to some extent the issues you're talking about in a way so that the water analogy is no longer there, that you can put as many tubes in there to some extent for a longer period of time, and also collecting rainwater large, like Tennessee floods, if we collected more of the Tennessee floods,
yeah,
or collected more of the East Coast floods from this winter,
yeah,
how much of that could we say could be collected usably?
Sure, great question. Let me see if I can disaggregate them. So let's first talk desal. Desal plants are certainly going to be part of the portfolio. There are a number proposed in California. Poseidon is constructing one, Carlsbad right now. It's going to be a contributor. Will it solve the water crisis? No. You have to deal with the issues I mentioned in my talk about price, energy, and disposal. There are some proposals, for example, in Arizona where I live, which is just about here. This is the Baja Peninsula, and this is the Sea of Cortez. And there's a proposal to put some desal plants in there, but it's such a shallow body of water that you don't get the movement of water back and forth, so you get the salt buildup. Far better would be along the Pacific coast here, if you can move the water not right at the coast, that's going to hammer the estuaries, but if you can move it out into the Pacific trough, where you have big currents moving the water back and forth, then the dissipation of the additional salinity will occur. That's the first one on the desal. Capturing additional water is something that people would like to do, and that's one of the impetuses in California now for Governor Schwarzenegger's effort to build some more dams. I don't have a dog in that fight, but the environmental community scratches its head and says, you know, these rivers already have dams and they're not filling. Why do you want a new dam on a river when you already have a dam that's not filled? And the answer is exactly for this gentleman's comment, which is in those occasions when you have really high flow events, if you had an additional storage facility, an additional reservoir, you could park the water there until you get it needed. So that's just an ongoing debate among water policy people.
about the need for additional reservoirs. It's maybe even more acute in two other places. It's acute in Texas, where reservoirs have always been the solution. And one of the supposed solutions in Georgia is to create some more reservoirs. So that's it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
About earlier point about the solution of water reform and keeping water local, could you talk about the challenges of foreign ownership or foreign rights to water? I think, for example, in the case of Georgia,
yeah.
I think Vivendi, a French corporation, owns a large, or perhaps has rights
to it. They did, yeah. Okay, well, the keeping water local thing I'm thinking of is a way of taking effluent and being able to reuse it and recharge it. But the bigger political issue that you're referring to, I think, has to do with so-called water privatization. Are we going to concede to private companies ownership over water? And I'm not at all in favor of that. But I want to make it clear that privatization means many different things to different people. It can mean something as simple as a private company that operates a billing system for a local utility. It means outsourcing to the private sector things that the government could do for itself but chooses to have the private sector do it. And, you know, that's just an ideological fight on where you want to put your money and how you want to get things done. But where the juices start to flow and where the red flag in front of the bull comes up is with the idea of a private company owning the water supply. Now, Atlanta tried privatization, bringing in a private company. It was a complete disaster. It was the old comment of hope over experience. You know, the person that gets married for the seventh time. The triumph of hope over experience. You should have known better by that point in your life, but you don't. You know, the company thinks they're going to make a killing. Atlanta thinks they're going to avoid this big revenue requirement because they'll get the company to put in new pipes. You know, corruption followed. Indictments, people went to jail. It was just a terrible experience. On the other hand, Indianapolis has a privatized water system that's been working well for decades. So I think that the devil is in the details on water privatization. The thing that I think is interesting is in many parts of the world, privatization is a terrible thing, and it's absolutely terrible. I don't think there's any doubt about it. In Bolivia and South Africa and a few other African countries, it's been horrible. In the United States, we have a slightly different democratic situation because we have public utility commissions in every state, and they are either elected or appointed. They are clearly they see their role as protecting the consumer, and the companies have to abide by their rules and regulations. Now, I'm not saying they always get it right, but it's a kind of institutional check on it. That said, I want to make one more point. There's no reason to concede private ownership of water to a public, no reason to concede that our public supply of water should be privatized and now owned by a private company. And although there are water rights in the United States, they're not ownership rights. In the United States, water is a public resource, and you can obtain rights to use the water, but they are always subject to the government's control. And so in this era of the market that I'm talking about, I mean, I know you've seen markets, you know, sort of go hand in hand, but I mean, there's no such thing as a free market. A free market depends on property rights. Property rights are created by the state, so you start with the state deciding what kind of rights you have. So what I want is a system of encouraging people to buy and sell water, but it's subject to government regulation in order to protect both the third parties who might get harmed by the system and also the environment. I'm going to stay around all night, but you folks have other things to do. How about one last question and we'll end the formal session?
My question is, are you here to talk to the city at all, the city of Chicago?
I'm going to be in the city tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about your role with the city?
Oh, no, it's the Regional Planning Council, and they asked me to come in and give a keynote. We've got something going on tomorrow morning, so I'll be there. And then there's another meeting, a lunchtime meeting.
So you're not dealing with the Department of Water Management?
No.
But you're dealing with at a more policy level?
Yes. Yep. Okay, that was the last one. I'm going to let you all go. I'll stay all night and try and answer some questions.